Bank of England fires the starting gun on its search for a new governor. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig, filling in for Anu Anand. Good morning. First, though, British Prime Minister Theresa May overruled senior cabinet colleagues to give the go-ahead for Chinese telecoms giant Huawei to supply equipment for the UK's 5G data network. Some ministers were concerned after the US raised its own security objections. The BBC's Su Ping Chan reports.
Huawei has reportedly been given a green light to supply equipment to the UK, but the British government has taken a cautious approach. The basic stuff like antenna are okay, but there will be no Huawei gear at the heart of the UK's 5G infrastructure. Huawei has always denied being controlled by the Chinese government or that its work poses any risks of spying or sabotage. Kieran Martin, the chief executive of the National Cyber Security Centre, which oversees Huawei's current work in the UK, said Britain's defences were robust.
It does change some of the ways we think about security, but it doesn't change some of the fundamental concepts of security. And some of the 5G infrastructure is built over existing networks, so it's not as if we're completely reinventing the wheel here.
Others aren't so sure. Tom Bossert, a former US Homeland Security advisor to President Trump, outlined three issues.
The first concern is about the reliability caused by some affirmative action on the Chinese part to take down some component or to sabotage some component of your telecommunications. The second is a future decision to steal some of our information that I think we can mitigate to some extent. And the third is just the poor reliability of poorly engineered and badly manufactured products that are rushed to market.
While a final decision is yet to be made, Huawei welcomed what it describes as the UK's evidence-based approach. However, it now risks causing a divide in the so-called Five Eyes intelligence alliance between the US, UK, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. After all, the UK is still eyeing that post-Brexit trade deal with Washington. In London, I'm the BBC's Su Ping Chan for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. Global stocks are little changed, while Nissan shares dropped 4% in Japan after the automaker issued its second profit warning this year. It's battling sagging sales amid its Carlos Ghosn ouster. Know any job seekers with, quote, the ability to use sound judgment to make decisions in a timely manner against a backdrop of uncertainty? You might point them to the Bank of England. That's one of the traits the central bank is looking for in its next governor, who will replace Mark Carney. He was the first non-Brit to lead the bank in its more than 300-year history. The BBC's Audrey Tinlin has details of the bank's search for its next successor.
After two-term extensions and more than 6 years in the job, Mark Carney will leave his role on January 31st. In a job posting, the BOE says a successful applicant will have substantial experience and be able to demonstrate the ability to lead a complex and powerful financial institution. Already, speculation has swirled about possible internal candidates, including the bank's deputy governors and its chief economist, or even those beyond the UK's border, like Raghuram Rajan, the former head of India's central bank. But the use of a headhunting firm for the first time suggests Treasury Secretary Philip Hammond, who will interview candidates and make the final appointment, would like to consider all possible options, and he's under pressure to also consider more female candidates. While Brexit's complexities, which after all convinced Mr. Carney to stay on at the bank well beyond his set five-year term, might put off some applicants, it's still a prime job within one of the world's most powerful central banks. And it includes a base salary of £480,000, a figure that hasn't changed since 2013. In London, I'm the BBC's Audrey Tinlin for Marketplace.
Love your morning cup of joe? Sip on this. Global consumers drink more than 500 billion cups of coffee every year. That number is only set to rise thanks to a boom in millennial demand. The BBC's Vivian Nunes explains how Dubai is cashing in on the lucrative craze.
As we know, the world's coffee market is enormous, and Dubai wants to centre itself in the middle of coffee producers or growers and coffee consumers. So if you think about where Dubai is located in the Middle East, it sort of makes sense to have coffee producers in Ethiopia and Kenya, also Vietnam and India, shipping their coffee beans to Dubai to get processed there and then exported onward to consumer markets, both in Europe, where we know most of the world's coffee is consumed, but also in the Middle East itself, there's actually a growing demand there for artisanal coffee. They've had chain store coffee for a couple of decades now, but now they're moving into more sophisticated cafe culture.
Now, one of the most intriguing parts of Dubai's plan is that it's using a tried and true method from the country's tea industry.
That's right. So just next door, actually, is the Dubai Tea Centre. For about a decade now, it's been importing tea, processing there and exporting that product. So one good example is a UK brand called Taylors of Harrogate. They used to import their tea, which was grown in India and Kenya, all the way back to the UK, do the blending, the processing there, put it into tea bags and ship it off to markets in Australia. Now that tea is just going from India and Kenya straight to Dubai. That's where it gets processed, put into tea bags and shipped to Australia from there. So they're really cutting down the time it takes from that tea to be grown to consumers in their cups. So that's sort of the idea of what Dubai wants to do with coffee as well.
But there are critics of these kinds of processes because they say this kind of production should be done locally, not only to benefit local farmers and producers, but also to help green the supply chain so it cuts out travel time for products between when they're raw materials to when they're finished.
Yeah, there certainly are critics, not particularly of this centre itself, but of the coffee supply chain generally. Now, it's thought that 80% of coffee farmers, that's 20 million people, are trapped in a cycle of subsistence farming. They often have very little access to markets. They rely on middlemen to export their coffee beans to process them. And many NGOs, campaign groups say if that process of processing, roasting, packaging and exporting was done much closer to home near those coffee farms, much more of the profits, and we're talking about a $1 billion industry, we all drink coffee, more of those profits could go to the poor growers themselves.
The BBC's Vivian Nunes there. I'm always in need of an extra cup of coffee. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.